Kata on opening the sutra. The Dharma incomparably profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize the Tathagata's true meaning.
Yun Yan asked Dao, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with so many hands and eyes? Dao Wu said, it's like someone reaching back for the pillow at night. Yun Yan said, I understand. Dao Wu said, how do you understand? Yun Yan said, all over the body is hands and eyes. Dao Wu said, you said a lot there, but you only got 80%. Yun Yan said, what about you, elder brother? Dao Wu said, throughout the body is hands and eyes. So I've heard that the Chinese government fears and represses the Taoists, because over the course of that country's history, they have periodically emerged from the mountains and led populist revolts against the ruling regime. History has shown that when they decide to act, they can be a force to be reckoned with. On the other hand, Buddhists in China currently face much less repression because their history has been passive. They have no record of emerging from the monasteries in support of political change. In a sense, that is our heritage as Buddhists, one of political quietism, in spite of some notable exceptions in recent times, such as in Vietnam and Myanmar. It appears that there are several broadly held perspectives within the contemporary American Buddhist community that support this basic tendency to eschew political and social controversy. The first of these is the idea that the affairs of this world are unimportant, that a higher spiritual plane, that of the absolute or emptiness, is the true reality, and that dwelling there, we are freed from suffering in this life. A similar, more contemporary idea is that we practice in order to live exclusively in the present moment, mindful, and therefore personally liberated, calm, and freed from stress and strife. Zen is a Mahayana practice. As such, it isn't aimed at dwelling in the absolute, living in nirvana. Zen talks about the relative and the absolute as being one, a fully integrated reality. As Hitoshi Chen reminds us, to encounter the absolute is not yet enlightenment. In the final stages of practice, we must lose our attachment to the absolute, instead using our realization to inform our actions as we enter the marketplace to deal with the often difficult, messy, and painful actualities of this world of samsara. The Bodhisattva archetype is that of a person who gives up their own place in nirvana to return to this world for the sake of all beings. One way to understand this is not in the context of actual death and rebirth, but rather in the sense that we constantly need to relinquish nirvana, the blissful state that we experience when residing in the absolute, continually returning to the world of samsara for the sake of other beings. We need to be reborn in each moment. A second reason for avoiding social political action is the idea that enlightenment or deep spiritual awakening should be a prerequisite for taking action. And until we've had that experience, we should focus single-pointedly on our practice. This viewpoint is based on several misapprehensions, the foremost of which is that enlightenment is an actual object, a discrete, observable, constant thing that appears at some moment in a person's life. Perhaps this belief is fueled by the accounts of very dramatic, sudden Kensho experiences. Firstly, while those do occur, for most people the process is not that dramatic. It is a succession of openings, each helping to gradually deepen the person's awareness. Secondly, referring to Sito Shichen's statement that encountering the Absolute is not yet enlightenment, even when the earth-shaking sudden Kensho does occur, many years of practice remain before that experience is fully integrated into the person's life. And even then, it remains a practice of moment-to-moment awareness to sustain the open, realized state. I believe that it is most accurate to say that one is never enlightened, that enlightenment is something we aspire towards as we practice throughout our lifetime, awakening again and again in each moment. It is not a constant state that we can reach and reside in. If we are waiting for enlightenment as a prerequisite for action, we will allow the possibilities of a lifetime to pass us by. The third is that by simply sitting and saving ourselves, we are in fact changing the world, and therefore we should invest all of our energy there. I would not dispute the first part of that belief. This is truly one body, and therefore our lives do matter. Our awakening does change the entire universe. Nor do I take complete exception with the second part of that idea. Awakening does take a powerful, single-pointed effort. But I don't agree that it needs to supersede everything in our lives. We need to apply assiduous effort both in our daily practice of Zazen and in the intense environment of Sesshins. But we should also similarly invest ourselves wholeheartedly and without hesitation in the rest of our lives. That too is practice. That too is Zen. In fact, for those of us who are householders, Zen practice should not take precedence. It must remain in balance as a very important aspect of our complex, multidimensional lives. Still, from the first time we sit down on the cushions, we get glimpses of clarity, moments of less self-centered, more open awareness. Regardless of how long we have practiced, or whether we believe ourselves to be enlightened or not, those times of clear insight need to become the basis for action. As we sit here today, we are in the sixth era of species extinction, a time when more species are disappearing from the earth than in the time of the dinosaurs. This is truly an emergency of epic proportions, especially since the vast majority of these extinctions are the result of human activity. Additional consequences of that activity are the rapidly shifting climate as carbon dioxide emissions rise, the depletion of the ozone layer, large-scale processes of deforestation and desertification, nuclear accidents, global resource depletion, and so on. Never before has all life on Earth been in such jeopardy. This is further compounded by the fact that the competition for dwindling resources is resulting in human conflicts. Blood is being shed for oil, but that may be nothing compared to the future conflicts as not just oil, but the Earth's water supplies vanish. I would argue that as Zen practitioners, we must act as the koan says, like reaching for the pillow in the middle of the night. When the pillow slips away, we don't stop and think, I must remain focused on the Absolute. I'm not concerned with the unimportant fact that my head is uncomfortable. Nor do we wonder whether we are enlightened enough to reach for the pillow. Nor do we imagine that because we sat Zazen that day, the world has changed and pillows are no longer necessary. We act completely reflexively. There is no thought. We just reach out and stuffs the pillow back under our head. That is a description of the action of compassion. True compassion is spontaneous, natural, comes from a place of not knowing. In the Zen Peacemaker's Order, there is a simple template for Buddhists to follow in taking action, which has three parts. Not knowing is the first of these, followed by bearing witness and loving action. Not knowing means just that, letting go of all that we think we know about a situation, including our conceptions, our preconceptions, our beliefs about right or wrong, and most importantly, the very idea of separation. We enter the situation completely open and unfettered. Therefore, we are able to respond as the situation requires. Secondly, we bear witness. This is an extremely powerful way to interact with the realities of suffering, destruction, violence, and death. In bearing witness, we sustain our gaze. We hold the intimate space open, refusing to close our eyes, turn away, or use psychological mechanisms to protect and distance ourselves. In this case, we must not allow ourselves to be diverted by despair. We cannot simply say, the problems are too big, there is nothing I can do. It may sound trite, but every day we are either part of the problem or part of the solution. If we face the source of our despair directly, we don't allow it to rob us of our power. Remarkable things can begin to happen when we allow this direct encounter to happen. Finally, we act with loving kindness. In this case, it is necessary that we interact with the world, Gaia, in such a manner that we treat the great earth itself as well as all beings within this vast, pulsing, living organism with love and kindness. Simply, as in the perspective of deep ecology, we must consider the well-being of the entire biotic community, not just our narrowly defined human needs. We must not only do this in our major resource allocation decisions, but even in the minutest aspects of our daily lives. This means that we cannot live in a dream state, acting blindly, unaware of the consequences. We must waken every minute, open to not knowing, bearing witness to the deep realities of our actions and their consequences, and allowing this realization to give birth to clear, decisive, loving action on behalf of the world. When our mind is in the right condition, it is very, very simple. Like reaching for the pillow in the middle of the night. So what I did mention at the outset, I probably should, that this is this, essentially the second in a little series of talk that began with that Brian S. Wilson talk, and this kind of follows from it, and I've got a couple more planned behind this one.
The bearing witness piece is tough for some people, really tough.
The only thing that I would disagree there is for some people, I think for everybody.
Yeah, well, okay, for everybody.
I think
I say it's a lot tougher for my husband, you know, when he approaches anything that raises discomfort with him, he will back away and go in his little corner and turn the music up.
Well, he's not alone.
Oh, I know. I know, and I have a lot of compassion for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but it's just... that very witness is tough.
Yeah, it is. And staying out of this despair state is tough.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been there myself many, many times. And I go, oh, what can I do about it? There's big corporations, there's big government, there's big, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they don't consult me on those decisions, and, you know. And so it's easy to just go, I can't do anything. And then well, so I might as well do nothing, kind of that. But what I've realized more and more, and I guess that's part of why I'm doing this particular series of talks, because I'm more and more convinced, and I'll talk about this as we go along, that government will never solve this problem. Because government is so entwined with the problem, you know. I mean, the root that I'm coming back to more and more is the root is greed. The root is greed. It's not capitalism that's the problem. It's greed that's the problem. And greed on this enormous scale, people who need to make hundreds of millions of dollars a year, you know what I mean? That kind of greed that I don't want to say we've never seen it before in human history, but never seen it on the scale, I think, that it exists right now. And that system of greed is so entwined with our system of government, with our, you know, and so on and so forth, that I just don't think that it is overwhelming and despairing if we try to imagine that we're going to govern our way out of this conundrum, because I don't believe that we are. I mean, you know, and initially, for example, I had hope for this president, as probably others in this room did. And what has he done to address it? Not a heck of a lot more than George W. did. And I think that's because the system is so constipated and bound up and unable to, you know, move out of its own way. But ultimately, we're the microbes that make it work. If we don't go to the store and buy the junk, then something's going to have to change. We do have power, but it's not at the ballot box. I believe it's with our wallets. I believe it's how we live our lives every day.
And where that becomes overwhelming for me is, and I hear what you're saying, and I agree, and where it becomes, the despair comes in, is I see us more consumer, 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 and where do I make a difference? Not that I won't,
no.
But where do I, when I see... What I see is the trend is more consumerism, more materialism, more violence, more greed. And to me, it all comes back down to fear.
Probably is certainly a big part of it. No, I think you're asking a really important question, Pam. And you know, I think for me, there's a couple of answers. One answer is I've just got to reach for the pillow. I can't.
Right.
You know, you kind of... You know, but at another level, I think it's, you know, the more of us that are successful in stepping off the treadmill and can model that, can speak out about that, can, you know what I mean? It's kind of, and I don't mean, you know, on street corners or, you know, but I mean just in our own lives, with our friends, with our families, with whomever, to say, you know, oh no, I don't want that this year for Christmas because I'm not, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever it is that starts, oh. So one molecule at a time, we're kind of affecting the process. I mean, there are other people thinking this way, you know, and it's, I think it's a growing number. Ellen Tyna just sent me, you know, a couple of a thing from the little house blog, and it was like a young couple. I think they were in Oregon, of course. That's one of those pink old places. it said urban, so I was thinking it didn't look urban, but maybe they were on the edge of Portland or someplace. So, you know, but you know, they had just built themselves this little tiny house, completely off the grid. And so this, you know, instead of a young couple aspiring for the condominium and the, you know, and the whole thing, you know, and I don't know, I think they built the thing, but, you know, looked like a lot of old recycled things, so they probably built this house for $450 or whatever. But just that, there are people, you know, taking these steps, making these changes. You know, is it a groundswell yet? No, I don't think, you know, but can it be? Yeah, I mean, you know, just that, if we can get past the despair or even the kind of wondering, can it work, won't it not, you know, but just start doing it, you know, and infect a few others along the way. That's where I see the hope, because I don't see the hope. Congress, they can't get out of their own way. President really is really quite powerless in terms of being able to make changes in the system. And you
know. However, eventually, my sense is the change will come from us, and I think, in order for that, I mean, not to rely on government, but in order for that to, the change to really occur, we're going to want people within the government to join us. You know, it's not going to happen without them too, I don't think.
Well, eventually they will, but because they're self-serving, they want to win elections. But you know, but if we look to them for the leadership on this, we're not going to get it because you know they're too intricately involved with the lobbyists, with the big corporate things, with the it's like if you look at this, in order for this change to happen, one of the things I think has to happen is the economy's going to have to take a hit. The type of economic model that we have that calls for constant growth, is not sustainable. We have to go to an economy that's flatline, or relatively flatline. And that's a huge transformation. And that's going to be a painful transformation if when it ever comes. It's going to come. Whether it comes by design or through catastrophe, it's going to come. You know, so as communities, as you know, we should be looking at how we're going to adapt with that. You know, what can we do to get by with less money? Can we grow our own food? Can we become more sustainable in our personal lives and you know, using less fuel or using these kinds of things? I mean, I think it comes down to very simple things, but because and it's interesting. A year or so ago, I heard a woman economist on. Was she an economist? Yeah, I think she's an economist on NPR. And she was talking about the Netherlands. And the Netherlands decided, as a country, they would go to a 4-day work week. And that had some really interesting effects. First of all, everybody had more free time, and everybody was happier. You know, across the country, people were more satisfied with their lives, they had more time to spend with their families, their children, et cetera, enjoy recreation, and so on. Part two was, you now had everybody doing less work, so unemployment virtually went away because they had to hire all those additional people to keep up, kind of fill in the work that people were now missing doing on their fifth day. So essentially, they needed 20% more people in the workforce than they had before. And the third thing was that everybody made less money, but the consequence was deflation. So the prices of things came down, and for the most part, people didn't notice the fact that they had less money. They now had more time, just about the same amount of money, and no unemployment. That's an example of a whole country getting off the squirrel wheel, you know, the treadmill, to some extent, you know. That's a problem. But you know, and so that this woman had been studying that as an economist. I'm pretty sure she was an economist, was her skill. But so I think there's possible, creative, innovative things that but that gets out of the whole paradigm of buy more, spend more, make more money, you know. And you know, it almost embodies that element of the voluntary simplicity movement that says, no, our time is our most precious commodity, not our money. And you know, certainly something that Thoreau believed in.
Well, our economy is based on commercialism, right? Consumerism. I mean, isn't that the? And I don't think people are aware of alternatives to that. I don't think I am.
I think there's a lot of encouraging stuff going on with non-consumerism.
With what?
With non-consumerism.
But isn't our economy based on?
Well, yeah.
Consumerism.
But I think there are more and more people. In fact, I was just reading something the other day that said that younger people now are much less inclined to care about stuff like upward mobility and material stuff. And they're opting for having part-time jobs, not all the time, but sometimes part-time jobs and spending much less money and having smaller houses. The small house movement is huge now. Mm-hmm. And getting off the grid is getting bigger. And so I think that there's a lot of
My hope is that that will grow. But I'm always, when I was young, there was a whole different set of ideas, and then at some point, everybody's parents said, all right, cut the crap, go get a real job, get a real house, cut your hair, and people did. And all of a sudden, the back to land movement of the 70s disappeared virtually, except in Unity, Maine.
But back then you could get a job, and now you can't always get a job. So
that
argument loses a lot of steam when, in some cases, it's necessity. You can't make the money that.
Well, maybe that's an opportunity, right? Maybe that's an opportunity. It doesn't welcome, the economy doesn't welcome. But back to Deborah's question. I mean, not only is it based on consumerism, but it's based on perpetual growth. If the CEO made $100 million this year, he or she wants to make two more often than not. He wants to make $200 million next year. If the shareholders got an 18% return on their investment this year, they want a 23% return on their investment. So nobody's saying, okay, enough is enough. We like an 18% return. Just give us that every year and we'll come to the meeting and cheer for you. If you give us 18% again next year, we're coming in, we're going to kick your ass out, and we're going to get in a CEO who's going to make us. So it's that kind of that's the insanity. It's like that there's never enough. There's never people saying enough, enough, enough. These salaries, they're just, why does any human being need to make more than $500,000 a year? I mean, that's pretty,
I'd like to make half that.
But you have people making 50 times that or 100 times, it's just crazy. The system of a free market, the free market has just gone insane, driven by greed, and it's got to be more and more and more and more. Not enough, enough. It's not enough that you buy a television. You got to buy a, I don't know how big they even get, 90 something.
Yeah.
50 is like, I don't know, huge.
That's
huge
for me.
But now it's a whole wall. This whole wall would be, people are getting televisions that,
I think that's a critical point, the difference between being satisfied with something that you have and not being satisfied, where the greed comes in. It's a whole different sensation, being satisfied and not wanting more.
Well, and greed demands that we're never satisfied. All the advertising, all the everything is about whatever you have, it's not enough, whether it's money or things.
I know, but some of us are impervious to that. Now, why are we impervious to that?
My hypothesis would be the cycle of greed is the cycle of the hungry ghost trying to fill that stomach that can never be filled. Well, what is that? Because I think we're trying to fill the stomach with the wrong things.
Avoid.
Instead of filling it spiritually, instead of filling it in terms of our human relationships, instead of filling it in terms of our relationships with the natural world and all of that, we're looking for material. And people can talk all they want about God, but we have made material possessions our God in this culture. And so people are going to the shopping mall looking for salvation. And no matter how many trips you make to that mall and how many makeovers you do and how many, you're just never gonna, it's never gonna fill the deep human needs that we have for connection, the deep human needs that we have for relationship.
I think the Pope made that point, did he not?
He's a darn good Pope, isn't he?
Breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
I think if the more people that stop trying to keep up with the Joneses, maybe the Joneses won't try so hard to stay ahead of us,
But my sense is people try to keep up with the Joneses because that's where their sense of self-esteem is. And the real issue is people's disconnection. Mm-hmm. That, the only patient that ever walked through my door was somebody with self-esteem issues. They may come in all different guises, all kind of different problems, but the bottom line was a connection, authentic connection with someone. And that's where we come, I bump up against Zen a little bit because that, but I think it's having a self or having a sense of self, and then being able to go beyond that. But so many people are so wounded, and that car makes them feel good.
Well, I mean, I just keep coming back to the Four Noble Truths, right? You know, I mean, Buddha said this 2,500 years ago, that we suffer. Why do we suffer? Because we think we need, or we think we need something other than we have, and we want to push things away and pull other things to us, and, you know, what's the solution to that? It's, you know, it's realizing that none of those things are ever going to fill it. And once we see that, once we have an intimate experience of that, then you can't unsee it. I mean...
That's right. Yeah, you can't go back to not knowing.
Yeah. It's the old, it's like this, the expression, you know, the expression, the, like a head full of AA and a belly full of beer don't mix, you know? So it's like once your head sees it differently, then it's never going to be satisfying again. You can never go to the mall and buy something and feel good about it. You know, kind of that kind of thing. Or, you know, I don't say never, but yeah. It's going to, you know what I mean? It's, you know, because once your consciousness shifts about these, about material possessions, it's quite the opposite. You know, you may feel good that you don't go buy something. Oh, no, I just, or, that you're able, you know, the feeling, good feeling comes out of, oh, I've kept my car a couple of more years longer, or I'm using less power, or, you know, I mean, it's all, you know, it's a complete shift. It doesn't say we shouldn't feel good, or we shouldn't, but let's feel good about the things that are sustainable. you know, and it also doesn't say we're never going to go and buy something. I mean,
no,
but again, it's going to be, in my view, it should be a conscious, well thought out, deliberate decision, as opposed to that impulsive, I'm here, I've got my credit card, I'm buying it, you know. That's where...
And I need that Beamer instead of that car that will get me...
Yeah, that perfectly good car that's got another... I was having a conversation like this with my son in Vermont, and I said, we've got going about how long the average American keeps their car. And I said, well, I think it must be something really short, like 5 years.
And he said, it's less than that.
It's 3 years. You know?
Yeah.
So... Just that. Imagine if everybody, instead of keeping their car 3 years, kept their car 6 years. I'm not saying 15 or 10, you know, just that. But again, that would have big consequences, you know, in all those places that produce cars, they'd have to really, you know, look at life differently. I don't know what will take as a culture for us to be ready to do that. In a certain sense, what we're talking about is simple, what we're talking about is necessary, and in another sense, it's like revolutionary. It's just, you know, it's just as revolutionary as saying we're going to take guns and run, you know, because if people stop buying cars, as you know what I mean, right? Boy, those car manufacturers would be up there on Capitol Hill having the National Guard come out or something, you know. We're in this thing, it's going to be a painful mess to extricate ourselves from in some ways.
We are blessed that we're in Maine, though. I mean, you can find kindred spirits around that, you know. The guy at the Oakland Gump is wonderful. Yeah. I just love him to death. He's like, well, because I'm always scrounging, and he's like, oh, yeah, take this rug, do this. That's what it's all about. And Maine is full of those folks. And I don't know other places very well lately, so when you visit and all you see are shopping centers and throughways and housing projects, it's like, we're blessed. We better keep it going here.
Well, there's something I read recently, that the turning point in human history was the 1950s. And if you think about it, that the people who came up through the Depression were extremely frugal. And they were extremely frugal till the day they died. My parents did not buy one unnecessary thing. I mean, you know, they spent years debating before we bought our first television set, or, you know, and that sort of thing. So it wasn't that generation, or at least, you know, kind of, you know, but the 50s things started to change. I mean, that's when Madison Avenue really emerged as a major force in this culture. And that's where, frankly, I think my generation really began the process of of rampant consumerism, you know, and you know, that older generation never really bought into it. They were too, you know, maybe not for the right reasons. They were very fearless.
Yeah, I was going to say, their reasons were not.
No, their reason was fear. Their reason was, oh my God, if tomorrow the banks close again, or if tomorrow, you know, they, having lived through that, they, that was a defining experience. That and the Second War in their consciousness. But regardless, they sort of never bought in completely. But it's sort of, you know, the generation that came up through in the 60s that really embraced it. You know, there were no Mac mansions back in 1955, or maybe Elvis Presley's, or, you know, you know, and all that. And,
is it not to like pat myself on the back or whatever, but what one really empowering thing for me over the last 5 or 10 years has been, I buy almost everything used, either from Goodwill or off of eBay. I mean, right down to my clothes. You know, I can't always find the clothes that I want at eBay, but I'm like, I need a new pair of jeans, or at Goodwill, I need a new pair of jeans. I'm going to go look on eBay and see what, you know, it's something that might go into the garbage if I didn't buy it. And it's, you know, it saves me money, and that's really why I do it, because I'm cheap. But, you know, it also feels good to not, to know that my money's going to another person instead of some corporation that's just churning this shit out, you know?
Yeah, plus you can get better quality stuff at Goodwill very often than you can in these big department stores.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you keep running across L.L. Bean and...
And that doesn't mean I don't buy anything new. You know, this week I had a job interview, so I needed a nice outfit. So I went and I got a nice outfit, you know, and that was kind of expensive. But that was like the exception versus the, you know.
Plus that will last you for years. I mean, I think
when we're talking about this, again, isn't it, aren't we talking about the middle way? You know, don't never buy, but when you do buy, do it consciously and responsibly.
Yeah, well, I think we're always talking about the middle way to some extent. For sure. I mean, we don't want to, you know, we can also get crazy fanatical, you know, puritanical about it, you know, and I don't think it's about that. I think it's just about being reflective, mindful, careful.
And intentional,
right? You know, and somebody you might say, "Well, I just want that thing." There's no just real good reason, but all right. But you know, but I avoided the other 99 things, you know, that
you
I could have. You know,
you got a new computer this year. Maybe your other one could have limped along a few more. I got a new computer this year. I'm part of that consumerism, but I'm very thoughtful about, hopefully.
I think we have to look at, you know, there are people, as you know, who are online, as soon as a new phone is going to come out, they are there waiting. Doesn't matter how good their phone that they had was, it doesn't matter, you know what I mean, how new it was or any of that. It's that it's now not going to be the newest phone anymore, and they want to have the newest phone. That's, to me, that's the craziness piece, you know, which is different from saying, okay, this phone is not really meeting my needs any longer, and
this computer's on its last leg.
Speaking of which, it's sitting in the my hut, and I'm on call today.
Whoops!
I didn't bring it up with me when I came up.
I'm guilty of being somebody who really likes, you know, I've got a Subaru that's now. I got it in 2004, so, and it was a 2005, but it's still going, and we kind of have our cars for lots and lots of years. But I am somebody who, when it's time to get a new car, really enjoys that new car.
I think it's okay to enjoy things that we have. I don't think enjoying, in fact, I think the difference is making that enjoyment something that defines you, as opposed to just really, like, I was really happy when I got my Subaru last year, mainly because the car I had before that didn't go above 50 miles an hour, and, you know,
and when you're commuting,
and putted along, you know, and so it was cool to have a nice car, and that felt really good.
But it wasn't an extension of you, it was something you had.
You know, it's made my life easier in a lot of respects, but...
Yeah, I don't think it's consumerism itself, having things isn't the problem. It's when they get out of hand, it's the, you know, the greed part, when it's not enough. And then there's an ignorance part when I don't realize the consequences, and I'm sure that applies to some people. And I really do think that what you said about sort of self-esteem is a big part of, because I think people do things to make themselves feel good, to be good, to satisfy some hunger that won't satisfy. I think that's why some people drink and do drugs. And consumerism is just another way of drinking or doing drugs. Mm-hmm. And you can drink in a way that's just enjoyable and not a problem, but you can also do it to escape something. And so sometimes I think, at least in part, not just the sort of mechanism is the issue, but something deeper than that. I have a brother-in-law who's very involved in all this, in drug abuse and stuff, and trying to help because of some family things. And he's passionate about it, and I can't help think that part of what's missing is there's something that's underneath that precedes having the drug problem that leads to the drug problem, some deep unhappiness or something. And I think consumerism, when it's abused and overdone, can be like that. And so if I don't look deeply to what am I doing this for, and solve that problem.
It's its own drug.
Yeah.
And we pathologize drinking and drugs, right? If you drink so much that you're in the gutter, it's like, oh, that person's disgusting. Well, you know, but if you buy so much that, you know, that the world's in the gutter, then nobody blinks an eye at that.
Yeah. Unless you're a hoarder. Unless you're a hoarder.
And yet, the fact is that 10% of people drink 90% of the alcohol. So the alcohol manufacturing industry needs alcoholics. If the alcoholics weren't there, they'd only have 10% of their business, you know? And so you have that, you know, which is, to me, the parallel that you're drawing between addiction and, you know, substance addiction and consumer addiction. Very, very similar, right down to that. I mean, it's the same, you know, the industries need us to be addicts. They need us to be consumer addicts, you know. And again, I think it does rise out of the same hole, the same deficits, the same kinds of human suffering that doesn't get... And as a culture, we're sick, you know. We've blame my generation. I think we destroyed many of the institutions that... maybe with some good reason also, but we had institutions in place of community, we had institutions in place, you know, of sort of religious institutions, you know, and kind of in the 60s we said, it's all crap, we don't need communities, we don't need religions, we don't need, you know, we threw that off, we really tore down a lot of what historically was the glue of this society. You know, whether it was good or bad, I don't know, but it was there, it was glue, it was kind of, you know, and it still exists, I think, in some small towns and places like that, but for the most part, it was eliminated. So as a culture, we're adrift. We don't have those institutions, we don't have those markets.
I just read a novel which had Somali characters in it. And at some point, a mother made the decision to take her children back to Kenya, I believe, where they had been in a refugee camp, because of wanting her children to grow up with a sense of community, which they were not going to get here in the United States. Mm-hmm. That this was such an individualistic country that she knew that her children, the children would lose their culture, they'd lose the sense of community that she found critical to. And so she left.
It's interesting, you know, because as you know, Lewiston's got a huge Somali population.
Well, I think this book, I think the town is Lewiston. I mean,
yeah.
That's what I thought.
And right now, I think that the people that are there, they do have a very tight-knit culture, you know. They've got their mosque and you see them gathering, and they're a little bit insular, partially probably by design and partially probably because you know, the white people are nasty to them. But I think as you see the younger people growing up and leaving and going to college and stuff, I think that they're probably not as much a part of that as their parents, you know, and their younger brothers and sisters. And
I think that's the great American melting pot process. With each immigrant group, it's kind of that when they first come here, mm-hmm. they stay together. Both the family and the community stay closely together, knit together, everybody helps everyone that went out. They have these mutual aid societies or benevolent groups that you know, kind of take care of the more disadvantaged in the community and so on and so forth. And then at some point, the great American dream blossoms and people move, you know, and they don't even want to be part of that. I mean, my parents were the generation that rejected their ethnicity and that and culture, and they thought, you know, they saw it as, I don't know what, you know, kind of, they wanted to be Americans. They didn't want to be Jews, you know, or, you know, and that kind of attempt to kind of get rid of the identity. But we lose a lot, I think, when we make those kinds of.
Well, we're not very inclusive as a society at all. This group is here. You have to, if you go here, you have a better chance of this, and you know, it's all about seems to be status and who belongs to what, and it's sad for the most part. I mean, look at us. As you often say, now I don't see the homeless folks from downtown here, or you know, I don't know how you get around that, but it seems to be a given.
This is maybe off topic, but I think you have to go to them. You know, that there are, I mean, it's rare. Zen in America is very affluent, you know, but there are Zen communities in urban areas that have homeless people and, you know, and everything else coming to them, but I think that they're certainly not coming to this place in the middle of nowhere. And
yeah, you need a car to get there for one.
Right.
Well, you reach out more and do something, bring people off them. I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, no, I think it's right. I mean, if we had a storefront down on Main Street or something, we probably see a lot more diversity of people than we do, you know, tucked away here. Tucked away here is nice. It's quiet. It's like, you know, but yes and no. I mean, you know, ZCLA is like right in the heart of the city, right on the edge of the barrios. And yeah, I didn't see any. I'm not saying there's no Latinos there, but you know, it's still not bridging that. It's doing better than we are, but not only marginally better, because LA is huge populations of people of color, probably majorities in much of the city, and that's not the case. The Zen Center is pretty white and middle class still, you know.
And I think that contributes to consumerism too. Well, you know, when if you're moving up in society, then you choose to forget about where you came from, perhaps, or you know, you're looking for somebody that's going to further your position or put you in a little better status. So you have to dress a little bit differently. So you have a car that runs, maybe, etc. And you have to have an address.
And could part of it be that when your basic needs are met, you explore your more spiritual needs?
Well, that's certainly what Maslow said, and I think that that's also,
you know. And does that keep some of the homeless or whatever?
Look at black churches, though. You know, they're some of the most, at least stereotypically, sort of spiritual. You know, and you're looking at people that are often in great poverty.
Well, it's not just blacks, it's also poor whites, yeah. You know. But But often those are fundamentalist churches that are kind of offering the solution to your poverty, you know, in a sense. It's either if they were very simplistic, if you have enough faith in Jesus, you're going to get money, or the this world doesn't matter explanation, and so, you know, the fact that you're in poverty right now isn't important because once you go through the pearly gates, you're going to be embraced. I can't help judge it a little, but they have theologies that directly address that issue of poverty in a very simple, you know, we have nothing like it. We have nothing like that to offer. Oh, great, you're poor, you're suffering. Sit here for 10 years ago or so and see what happens. You know?
You're suffering? That's what's supposed to happen.
And what I make up is that fundamentalism can be sort of like materialism. It serves to fill that hole.
Yeah. It can be very addicting. It can be very addicting for many people.
Same kind of thing.
Finding it outside of oneself versus...
Yeah.
I don't want to demonize fundamentalism too much, though. I mean, I think, yes, that sort of hardline thing, you can criticize, but I do think that there are people that come out of that worldview that give anybody the shirt off of their back, because that's And so I think that... That's a real kind of spirituality, regardless of, you know, whether you could quibble with, the, you know, how close to actual reality it is, or.
Well, whatever spirituality we're into, it kind of serves our needs, which, so you can't really, I don't think you can point a finger, because that's us. Mm-hmm.
Well,
we're here because this suits us.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
What were you saying, Beth?
I was going to say, isn't that sort of always the question, am I going to this church, buying this thing or whatever? I mean, why am I doing it? What's, you know, I can be doing it for certainly a good reason, and I can do it for sort of an escaping, deadening, numbing, whatever. And... isn't it important that I think about that? Maybe that's part of bearing witness. What is actually going on? Why am I asking for that drink? Am I thirsty? I like the taste of it? Or do I feel like I'm terrible and I want to escape from some terrible thing that happened? You know, it's the same thing.
It is.
But I'm doing it for a different reason.
How we use the experience of living.
I mean, Peter's Dharma talk last week and the week before, you know, said the same thing, that we could use Buddhism, you know, we could come to this not to really wake up and experience the true nature of reality and not turn away and come to a place of compassionate action. We can use it to just, I want to feel better.
And I'm a Buddhist.
Yeah, you know, but I am thinking about that other thing. You know, many of my clients right now, they don't have things like down parkas or good wool coats. So how they accommodate to the weather this time of year is they wear virtually everything that they own sort of simultaneously. They just got two hoodies and, you know, a bunch of shirts and da da da, and then maybe they've gotten a coat somewhere. And so I'm thinking, you know them when you see them. Do you know what I mean? You know, if you go in a store or whatever, you see people who are looking like that. They don't look like us. Imagine what it must feel like for them to walk in that door here. Just that alone. You know what I mean? We don't look like them. You know, we all look different. We've all got a nice down coat or a nice, you know, whatever. And so that right there says, oh, I'm not like these people. So I think they're just that. I do think if we ever wanted to bridge to people, it's not so much people of color here because there aren't that many of them, but just the people who are of a different socioeconomic status, we would really have to go where they are and create a place in which they feel comfortable, so that it's not built in our image, but it's sort of built in their image, as it were, whatever that would be, you know.
Would be the pillow that they need under their head.
Yeah. I often think too, like, of all the sort of, even here where we try to be kind of more simple and not as uptight of all the sort of Buddhistic jargon that we throw around all the time, that we all know what it means, but somebody coming in has no idea. And, you know, I think we do a good job of, you know, like Peter, if somebody new here, he'll start talking about koans and then say, well, do you even know what that is? And, you know, give a little explanation, and that's great. Because I think there is this thing in Zen where we just expect people to figure it out, and, you know, and that's okay for some people, and I think that can be really scary, especially for people that are used to feeling stupid or feeling shut out or feeling like there are barriers to them everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I know where it comes from. I was talking with that in Vermont this week. I made some connection to folks at the Center for Mindfulness there, but one of the person who's sort of functioning as the teacher there spent quite a bit of time studying, including Buddhism in various parts of the world, including Zen in Japan. He said, in Japan, you get no instruction, none whatsoever. They don't teach you anything. You just follow along and flow it up, you know what I mean? And then when they flow it up, they sort of, you know, they glare at you, they whatever, you know. And you know, but they don't teach you at all. That's kind of, we've already come a long ways in that we talk, in that we explain things, you know,
they let somebody do a koan for the second time, being told, you don't need to do it again. I said, when were you going to tell me? I'm only kidding.
I think I did several koans for the second time before Peter told me that. So.
Well, I may not recognize that it's for the second time. So Oh, you all missed that Saturday when I talked about not doing the koans for the second time?
What am I missing on that?
I was doing a koan in the Book of Serenity. I'm in that book now. And I'm doing this koan. And I go, God, that sounds familiar. The names are different because, and everything, but the story's the same. And I look, and it's the second koan in the Gateless Gate. But it reads a little bit differently, but it's the same.
Well, you don't have to do it twice.
You missed that Saturday, too.
I thought we could do it if we wanted to do it.
Yes,
yeah.
You can.
Yeah, but that's what he told me. But he said you don't have to. Because and so I did, and I passed.
You are presumably a slightly different person.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was here.
Well, that's bringing up something
you might bring something new to it.
Well, that's, you've just brought up a really good point, because many lineages now are having people do the entire koan study over again a second time.
I think that would be helpful.
You don't think I'd live long enough to do it a second time. I'm hoping to get it through it the first time.
It's only about 600 koans, and then do them again.
Also, it's true you can't step in the same koan twice.
It's true. It's just a quick comment, then we'll end for today. Our koan system is based on the quantity. It's based on doing the many, many, many koans. And some affect you more deeply, some move you very profoundly, some you just get a little bit from, you know, so on and so forth. But by the end of koan study, you will have what you need. It's the nature of the process. So don't worry if you don't think you got all that you needed out of this koan. Or, you know, it won't matter. It'll come back again and again in different koans and different forms. And each time you'll get a little more of it and a little. I mean, that's the approach here at Treetop. And, you know, so occasionally somebody's concerned when I pass them that maybe they didn't get the koan, get everything out of it that they should. Don't worry about it. There's hundreds of the little suckers. And, you know, they'll come back and back. And again, some of the koans, it's not just the people. You know, some it's idiosyncratic to us. Sometimes a certain koan, one person will be in tears and completely moved and their whole world changed by koan, and somebody else will go, I really don't get this koan. You know, why are we doing this one? And so that's idiosyncratic, but it's also true to the nature of the koans themselves. Some of the koans are really profound, and other koans are just making a sort of a simple point that once you get it, yep, move on, because it's not, you know. Which in a sense is good, you know, in a sense it's good because it keeps holding it light. We're always looking for the profound depths in a koan. That's in itself a sort of an attachment. Just meet the koan and see what it gives you. Sometimes it's going to give you a lot. Sometimes it's going to give you a little bit. Sometimes you're going to say, ah, this is the most amazing koan. And sometimes you're going to say, why did they put this in the book? It's okay. Still the process is doing what it needs to do.
Somebody had some theory that there's only, like, really five koans, you know?
Wasn't
what?
Wasn't the mathematics guy?
Yeah, Mike Warboys.
Oh, I don't know.
That's where that originated. Mike Warboys somehow decided that all koans came down to something like that, five or six things. And if he could just figure out which one of those things it was, he could then go in and give his answer and pass the koan.
No, but I think that comes from before him, because I think Ruth Fuller Sasaki wrote a book on koans, and I think that I haven't actually read it, but I think that in it she kind of goes into there are sort of five kinds of koans, and here's what they are.
That's true, but yet each koan is discrete. They're infinite. Each koan is discrete, and each one can be seen in an infinite number of ways. And I'm not going to say of that infinite number of ways all would pass the koan or are correct, but there can be many possibilities with each koan. So, you know, it's like it's overall interaction. You know, like sometimes I use that rock polishing idea that, you know, those rock tumblers that if you put the stones in, you tumble them, tumble them, tumble them, and eventually you get all little smooth, round, pretty little stones. Well, there's no one tumble you can say, oh, that's the tumble on which they, you know, and, you know, or sometimes they bounce up and they miss a couple of tumbles. Doesn't matter because they get back in there and they get tumbled, you know what I mean? And if they're in there long enough and they tumble enough, they come out little pretty round stones. You know, I don't know if that's a desirable outcome, but that idea. So to me, that's how the koan study works. It's just tumbling, 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 and that process does what it needs to do over time. You know, don't worry if you miss a turn. If you're up in the air or you're under the water or you're someplace else when the tumble comes. Cause, you
know. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to perceive it. The enlightened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it.